me ask that you turn to Hebrews chapter 11. We're going to talk about an Old Testament figure tonight, but we're going to go to the New Testament to talk about him. And I'd like to begin by reading verses 8 through 10, and then reading verses 13 through 16 of Hebrews chapter 11. By faith Abraham obeyed when he was called to go out to the place which he would receive as an inheritance. And he went out, not knowing where he was going. By faith he dwelt in the land of promise, as in a foreign country, dwelling in tents with Isaac and Jacob, the heirs with him of the same promise. For he waited for the city which has foundations, whose builder and maker is God. Verse 13. These all died in faith, not having received the promises, but having seen them afar off, were assured of them, embraced them, and confessed that they were strangers and pilgrims on the earth. For those who say such things declare plainly that they seek a homeland. And truly, if they had called to mind that country from which they had come out, they would have had opportunity to return. But now they desire a better, that is, a heavenly country. Therefore God is not ashamed to be called their God, for He has prepared a city for them. From the prophets, the past couple of days, we've been talking about how people sometimes go through hard times. We've all been through hard times. And it's important when we are in hard times that we keep going. And a very profitable study is to look at individuals in the Bible who encountered hard times to see how they kept going. And Hebrews tells us how Abraham kept going. He kept going because he saw the city of God. And I want to talk about that tonight. But before we look at the life of Abraham and learn the secret of how he kept going, let me take a minute to again express my deepest appreciation to this congregation for having me come back, for the kindness and the genuine warmth and love that you show me, and to Mo and Janet in particular, to be able to stay in their bed and breakfast. This is now the third time I've been there. It's just a great place to stay. I'd recommend it to anybody who needs to get away for a few days. But they're wonderful people, and to be with all of you. Some of us go back a bit of a ways. Wally and Sandy and I go back to meeting them in the 2000-2001 there in Nashville. I preached at the congregation of which they were members when Wally was at Vanderbilt. And Craig and Denise, we go back. Craig's father, a great friend. He's been a blessing to my son Steve in so many ways. And to come and to be with you is just special. And I pray that God will bring us together again and God keep you until He enables us to all be together again. Hebrews was written to Hebrews to tell them to stop being Hebrews. And it's a book that we need today. Written to people whose lives were being shaken. Chapter 12 says that. People don't like to be shook up. They like things to be calm and peaceful and steady. But sometimes the reason God allows us to be shook up is to point us in the direction of those things which cannot be shaken. Verse 13 is talking about the patriarchs. They died in faith, not having received the promises. They died not having realized what God had promised, but they still died in faith because they saw those promises afar off, were assured of them, and embraced them. And what verse 13 says to me, among other things, is that this world is not our home. Chapter 13 says, here we have no continuing city, but we seek one to come. That was the city, verse 10, that Abraham was looking for. You know, a fugitive is someone running from home. A vagabond is someone who has no home. A stranger is someone away from home. A pilgrim is someone who's going home. And Abraham was a pilgrim. He was in a place that was not his home, but he was headed home all the while. And I want to talk from verses 8, 9, and 10 tonight particularly about how Abraham kept going. Verse 10 says that he looked for a city. And I want to take that idea of a city and to show how there is a city involved in verse 8, there is a city involved in verse 9, and of course there's a city involved in verse 10. In verse 8, there was a city behind Abraham. In verse 9, there was a city beside Abraham. In verse 10, there was a city before Abraham. And hopefully as a result of us looking at these three cities in relationship to Abraham, we'll be better equipped to handle the tough times that we go through. Let's talk first of all from verse 8 about the implied city there, the city that was behind him, Ur of the Chaldees. By faith, Abraham obeyed when he was called to go out. The out of which he came, from which he went, was Ur of the Chaldees. You know, every believer has turned their back on something. Sometimes it's very dramatic, sometimes not so dramatic. Every believer has had to leave something in order to turn to God. And sometimes what we've left wields a strong pull on us. The pull of the past. The pull of the familiar. The pull of the comfortable. And the writer tells us that had Abraham wanted, he could have gone back to the city that he left anytime he wanted. God has called us out, and one of the greatest judgments God can ever put on any of us is to give us the power, the ability, the free will to go back to what we have left. And that temptation was always before Abraham. But one of the great things about him is that he didn't go back. Now, I'm going to tell you what he turned his back on, what he left, what he did not go back to. He didn't go back to Ur of the Chaldees. And when you think of Ur of the Chaldees, don't think of a place like Chigger Creek, Texas. Ur of the Chaldees was an ancient civilization whose roots went back centuries. It was not some primitive Stone Age hamlet that Abraham came from. Sir Leonard Woolley did a lot of archaeological work there. He discovered that Ur of the Chaldees, about the time of Abraham, had a population of 300,000. They had a water system. They had schools where they taught the logarithm and the square root. They had vast buildings, villas of 14, 15 rooms. They had public libraries. Woolley said, at the time of Abraham, they were an old and highly civilized society. And Abraham lived there. That was his home. That's where his family was. That's where his job was. That's where his house was. That's where his religion was. And he had a life-changing experience there. He goes home one day and tells Sarah to pack the camel. She says, why? He says, because we're moving. She says, where are we going? He says, I don't know. Well, why are we going then? Because God said so. Somehow or other, God revealed himself to Abraham and told him to leave where he was at. I'd like to think that if God revealed himself to me that way, that I'd be just as ready to get out of whatever I needed to get out of. And Abraham turned his back on everything that we today believe constitutes the components of security. And he left it all, and he went out not knowing where he was going. You know, often people are unwilling to venture out until they know the back end at the front end. They want to know before they take that first step where they're going to end up, what they're going to find when they get there, how things are going to be. And when they know the back end, they're willing to make some movement on the front end. But that wasn't Abraham. He was willing to take that first step, to turn his back on everything, to probably deal with a lot of ridicule and second guessing from all of his family and friends, and to leave it all because God told him to get moving. And faith, and that's what Hebrews 11 is all about. Hebrews 11 illustrates that passage I mentioned this morning from Habakkuk 2:4, the just shall live by faith. If you want to know what God means by that, spend some time looking at Abel, and spend some time looking at Enoch, and talk about Noah, and then talk about Abraham. And one of the things God means when he says the just shall live by faith is that the person of faith trusts the person even when he cannot trace the path. Even when we don't know what the back end is going to be like. If the one we trust, in this case God, says go, the person of faith does that. By faith, Abraham went out. I remember Christ saying something about any man who puts his hand to the plow and looks back is not fit for the kingdom of heaven. I remember Christ saying something in the Gospel of Luke to the effect, remember Lot's wife. She left, but she looked back. I remember Paul says we need to forget the things that are behind. I read about God bringing the Israelites out of Egypt, the greatest nation on the face of the earth at the time, brought them out with a powerful hand, led them into the wilderness, and there they found out there weren't any water fountains, and there weren't any restaurants, there wasn't any food, they were in a trackless desert, and they started complaining. The devil told them, you know, you had life better when you were those slaves making bricks without straw back there in Egypt. And they started griping. And they started murmuring. And they told Moses, we'd rather go back and eat the onions and the leeks and the garlic of Egypt than be out here. I can't imagine what their breath smelled like after a diet like that. But that's what they wanted to do. They wanted to go back. And despite the fact God delivered them, they didn't trust that He could sustain them. And Abraham had the same kind of trouble. You know, he gets there in the land of promise. Land smack dab in the middle of a famine. Takes it upon himself to go to greener pastures down there in Egypt, down around the Delta region. And got in a lot of trouble down there. And so, to be a person of faith, we've got to put something behind us. It may be a friendship, it may be a job, it may be a family, it may be a marriage. It may be a religion. We've got to put something behind us. So there was a city behind Abraham. In verse 9, there was a city beside Abraham, and the city implied there is the city of Sodom. Abraham dwelt in the land of promise in tents. And when you go back and read Genesis 10, 13, 14, when you read Genesis 13, 14, Abraham could look over and see a city known as Sodom, at which time was located in a region that was so green and so fertile that when men looked at it, they were reminded of the Garden of Eden. That's how lush it was. Now, it's not like that anymore. When God's judgment fell on Sodom and Gomorrah, it burned the deepest hole in the face of the earth. You know, Death Valley is 200 feet below sea level, thereabout. The surface of the Dead Sea is 1,300 feet below sea level. The bottom of the Dead Sea is 2,600 feet below sea level. Where Sodom and Gomorrah and the cities of the plain were, there is now a hole a half a mile deep on the crust of the earth. But in the time that Abraham moved there, that was Las Vegas. That was Los Angeles. That was New York. That was the epitome of civilization and cosmopolitanism. And it was right over there beside him. You know, one of the toughest things in the Christian life is not leaving something. It's living where God calls us to live. Often the leaving is fairly easy. It's the living that gets tough. And verse 9 is talking about Abraham living in the promised land. You know, Henry VIII made a break with the Roman Catholic Church and established the Church of England. And he was succeeded by his son, Edward VI. And Edward VI continued the Protestant policies of Henry, his father. But Edward died, and his half-sister Mary, Queen of Scots, came to the throne. Mary was a devout Catholic. And she was determined to restore Catholicism as the state religion in England. And because she was zealous about her faith, she had many of these Protestant clerics who had risen to a position in the Church of England under Henry and under her brother Edward arrested and put to death. There's a famous story about the two bishops, Hugh Ridley and Nicholas Latimer, taken out, tied to the stake, the wood piled around them, and the wood set on fire. And Latimer lasted longer than Ridley. They put green wood around Latimer, and instead of just engulfing him, it kind of smoldered and burned away at the lower parts of him. And Ridley was in anguish, screaming, agony. Latimer yelled out to him, "Be of good courage, Mr. Ridley. This day we'll light a candle in England that'll never be put out." Now, at the time that Elizabeth I succeeded Mary, they didn't put up with Mary too long. They got rid of her. And when Elizabeth I came to power, there were 200 other Protestants locked up by Mary, sentenced to be executed, ready to die for their faith as much as Latimer and Ridley. Elizabeth Freedom. The historian says that in the subsequent years, many of those 200, ready to die for their faith, couldn't handle living for their faith, and left their faith, lost their faith, left Christ completely. Abraham didn't do that. And I want you to see three things he did in regard to the city beside him, in regard to Sodom. The first thing is that he separated himself from Sodom. He lived in a tent some distance from it. Now, his nephew Lot pitched his tent toward Sodom, ended up moving into Sodom, became one of the village trustees of Sodom, and as a result, lost everything in the conflagration of Sodom. But not Abraham. He stayed separated from it. You know, it's possible to live in the midst or in proximity to an evil society without being tainted by it? Now, it may be tough, but it's possible. John said, "Love not the world." And we can do that even as we live in the world. Christ said to his disciples, "I've called you out of the world. I'm going to send you back into the world, but you don't belong to the world." We Christians have been called out. One day we're going to be called up. And in between, we've got to live in this world being the light of the world, being the salt of the world. That's where God wants us to be. And one thing that has always killed the church is when it's taken the idea that there's only two options. Either you're in the world, lock, stock, and barrel, or you're completely separated from it. And many Christians have taken that completely separated mentality. We're not going to have any association with the world. We're not going to work with them. We're going to work with each other. We're not going to live among them. We're all going to congregate together. We're not going to be involved with them. We're going to limit our contact with them as best we can. And that's the way we're going to save ourselves from worldliness. And I'm going to tell you, historically, it happens every time. That kills the church. That kills the influence of God's people. How can you save somebody you're never in contact with? If you don't know your next door neighbor well enough to have them over for a cup of coffee and to do some socializing with them, you don't know them well enough to convert them. It is possible to be separated, to be unspotted from the world, to not be conformed to the world, and not be part of it. Separation does not mean isolation. Abraham was separate from Sodom. And because he was separate from Sodom, that leads to the second thing. He was able to save Sodom. Remember the story in Genesis chapter 14? Lot had moved into town, and a local tribal chieftain by the name of Chedorlaomer and some other tribal chieftains staged a raid on Sodom, carried away everything in town. Men, women, children, carried it all away. Everybody captured. And word comes to Abraham that his nephew Lot's been taken. I'll tell you what, if I'd been in Abraham's shoes and had heard that about Lot, I think I would have been tempted to think, well, you know, he made his bed, he's going to have to lie in it. I told him not to go down there, he wouldn't listen to me. There's not a whole lot I can do right now. But that's not what Abraham did. He got his hired men, he rallied his servants, he went after them, he fought a battle, and he brought all of them back. He's a better man than I am. Would you have done that for Sodom? Abraham did. He didn't dance on their grave. He didn't thank God that he had finally judged that ungodliness. He saved Sodom. You know, Jeremiah wrote a great letter to the exiles in Babylon. And when the day comes, they check me into an assisted living facility or nursing home, I'm going to read this letter. He sent it to people who did not want to be where they were. He sent it to people who wanted to be home. They've been carried out of their home. They've been put somewhere else. They had lost all kind of freedom. They had lost the ability to move around like they wanted. They had to answer to others, just like a nursing home. Jeremiah wrote him a letter, and he said, listen, you settle down in your new home. You make Babylon your home. You pray for your home. You love your home. You thrive in your home. You join the Babylonian PTA. You join the Babylonian JCs. You plant a garden there. You take pictures of your place and hang it up, home sweet home. That's what Jeremiah said. And by them doing that, Babylon was blessed. You know, Peter says we are strangers and pilgrims. And we live among people who are not believers, who are worldly. You know what Peter says we need to do in that situation? He says, honor the king, pay your taxes, be a good neighbor, do good. If we'll make that our intention, if we'll make that our goal and follow through on it, maybe we'll have an effect on saving our society, on redeeming it. So Abraham was separated from Sodom, but he saved Sodom, and the third thing he did was supplicate for Sodom. You know, the king of Sodom came out and met him when he was coming back from the Battle of the Kings there with Chedorlaomer, and the king of Sodom said, I tell you what, give us the people, you keep everything else. Abraham said, I don't even want to keep a shoestring. You take it all, you don't owe me anything. And then the day came when a couple of angels showed up at Abraham's door to tell him that Sodom was going to be destroyed. Abraham said, well, what if we can find 50 righteous people in town. God says, I tell you what, you find 50 righteous, we'll spare the city. They couldn't find 50. What about 45? God said, okay, 45. They couldn't find 45. They kept whittling down and down and down. Finally, Abraham said, Lord, what if we can find 10 righteous people? And I think Abraham probably thought he had it then for this reason. Lot, who was a righteous man, 2 Peter 2:7, lived in town. Abraham probably thought, well, there's Lot. There's his wife. He's got a couple of daughters with their husbands. There's at least two boys, and he has two unwed daughters. There's at least 10 righteous people, he probably thought, Lot's family. Now, when Lot tried to tell his family what was coming, they just laughed at him and ridiculed him. And that's the way sin works. Sin just gets into us deeper, makes us smell worse, makes us insensitive to the danger that we're in. But here's Abraham, unwilling to be associated with Sodom, but praying for the salvation, for the sparing of Sodom. And I think that's a pretty good template for us to follow in regard to our world. Let's stay separate from it. Let's do what we can do to save it. Let's pray for it. There was a city behind him. There was a city beside him. Sodom, but verse 10. There was a city before him. And that city was heaven. You know, about the only time people talk about heaven is at a funeral. Someone has to die before we talk about heaven. C.S. Lewis said that people today who do the most for the present world are those who think most about the next world. And since Christians have largely ceased to think about the next world, they have lost their influence in this world. I think he's probably right about that. Some of the great social changes that have been effected in this Western civilization of ours, the abolishment of slavery, the building of hospitals, the humanizing of the Industrial Revolution, and on, all came about as the result of Bible believers who were trying to honor God by the reformations and the changes that they worked for. And what I'm saying is, scripturally, heaven is not just a destination, it is a motivation. I want you to turn now back to the Gospel of John. Because in the Gospel of John, four times, turn to John 7. There is an expression that occurs where Jesus says, where I am. And each time I believe he's talking about heaven. And every time he uses that phrase, where I am, he attaches some significant truth to it. I want us to look at the four. In John chapter 7, look at verse 32. The Pharisees heard the crowd murmuring these things concerning him, and the Pharisees and the chief priests sent officers to take him. Then Jesus said to them, I shall be with you a little while longer, and then I go to him who sent me. You will seek me and not find me, and where I am, you cannot come. Now that's an unflinching truth. Christ tells these Jews, and he's speaking spiritually, as you keep reading, they understood him physically. That often happens in the Gospel of John. Christ is speaking up here at this level, and he is being interpreted down here at this level. Except you be born again. Well, how can I be born again? Oh, I can give you water that if you drink, you'll never thirst. Give me that water. You know, people just kept missing what Christ is saying. And he says, where I am, you can't come. And they think he's going to go off and hide somewhere. No, he's talking about going to heaven. And he's talking to unbelieving Jews. And he tells them, you unbelievers cannot come where I'm going. There are no unbelievers in heaven. And that is an unflinching truth. Christ said, except you believe that I am He, ye shall die in your sins. That doesn't hold out a lot of hope for the Hindu, or for the Buddhist, or for the Muslim, or for anyone who does not put their faith in the Son of God. I tell you what, I don't mind telling anybody that I'm ready to rise or fall, to stand or fall with Jesus of Nazareth. If I fall, I fall. But I think I'll stand with Him. And no one willing to put their faith in Him can be with Him in heaven where He is. You know, in John 4, when Christ is having that discussion with the woman at the well, if ever there was a chance, a time, for Jesus to endorse pluralism, I'm okay, you're okay, John 4 was the place. Now, Christ talks about the woman's moral background. She didn't want to talk about that. Well, let's talk about worship, she says. You know, our fathers worshipped in this mountain. And Christ doesn't say, yeah, you're right, and you know what? That worship is as good as the Jews' worship. He doesn't say that. What He says is, you don't have a clue what you're talking about. And He goes on to talk about true worship in spirit and in truth. Heaven is a motivation to believe in Jesus as the Son of God. Now look at chapter 12, verses 25 and 26. Let's read verse 24. Most assuredly I say to you, unless a grain of wheat falls into the ground and dies, it remains alone, but if it dies, it produces much fruit. He who loves his life will lose it, and he who hates his life in this world will keep it for eternal life. If anyone serves me, let him come, follow me, and where I am, there my servant will be also. If anyone serves me, him will my Father honor. You know what the two chief characteristics of a Christian are in the Gospel of John? Love, by this shall all men know that you are my disciples, if you love one another, and service. Christ rises from the Last Supper, ties a towel around Him, washes the feet, says, I have given you an example for you to follow. And what Christ is talking about in verse 25 and 26 is the importance of an unselfish life. And to talk about that, He uses the figure of something dying, a grain of wheat dying, being put into the ground. The devil tries to tell people when they come to Christ and realize they've got to put off the old man and be buried, the devil tries to tell us that's a funeral. That baptismal service is a funeral. You're being buried. No, it's not. We're being planted. And burial is part of planning. And there's a death that occurs that's part of living. There's a death that is the beginning. And that's what Christ is talking about. And He's calling us to selflessness, not selfishness. The ones the Father will honor are those who serve. And so, to be with Him where He is, we must face the unflinching truth that we must believe in Him. And then we must realize the importance of the unselfish life. And then John chapter 14, the first three verses. Let not your heart be troubled. You believe in God, believe also in me. In my Father's house are many mansions. If it were not so, I would have told you. I go to prepare a place for you, and if I go and prepare a place for you, I will come again and receive you to myself, that where I am, there you may be also. Now I know there are a lot of brethren who think Christ is talking about something other than heaven here, where He's going to go to prepare a place, where there are many mansions, abiding places, dwelling places. I tend to think He's talking about heaven. And I think what he's saying is that heaven is the basis for an untroubled heart. An unflinching truth, an unselfish life, and an untroubled heart. Some people are eaten up by anxiety. It controls them. It chokes them. But when you've got heaven as your perspective, you're not bothered by it. Remember in Acts chapter 12 when Peter's arrested, Herod's killed James, saw how the Jews liked that. So he says, if one dead Christian's good, two dead Christians must be better. Goes out and grabs Peter, throws him in jail. That night, God sends his angel to release Peter. Angel moves past the guards, gets the door open, goes in, says, Peter, get up. Peter keeps snoring. Finally, the angel kicks him, shakes him. Peter kind of gets up groggy, follows the angel out of the prison, and only then kind of realizes what's going on. Do you think you would have been sleeping that soundly, knowing that in the morning you were going to have your head chopped off? How could Peter have been sleeping so peacefully? I'll tell you what I think. John 21, Jesus says, Peter, when you die, you're going to be an old man. And you're going to be carried about where you don't want to go. Christ had spoken to Peter's death. It did not involve Herod killing him while he was still a young fellow. I think Peter had faith in the promise of Christ, and because of that, his heart was not troubled. Remember, we live by promises, not by explanations. Resting on the promises of Christ, we've got a basis for dealing with anxiety. And then finally, turn to John 17, where Christ prays for himself, he prays for the disciples, and he prays for the church, those who would believe on him because of the apostolic word. And in verse 24, John 17, Father, I desire that they also whom you gave me may be with me where I am. Now prior to that, back up in 20 and 21, he prayed that they all may be one. Heaven involves an unflinching truth, an unselfish life, an untroubled heart, and an undivided church. We're all going to be together. We're all going to be living in the same place. Let's learn to get along with each other now. Let's learn to be one with Christ in love and in serving one another. Now beware of the city behind you. Don't look back. Don't go back. Don't be sucked in by the city beside you. But keep your eyes on the city before you. Remember the story of Uncle Tom's Cabin? At the end of the story, Uncle Tom has been beaten severely by Simon Legree, the merciless, heartless slave trader. He's lying in the shed. He's dying. And the other slaves know he's dying, and they make their way to him to make their peace with him, to ask his forgiveness if they needed to tell him how much he meant to him. And George Shelby shows up. When Shelby was a young boy, Uncle Tom was a slave on his father's plantation. And that family loved Tom and cared for him, and he loved George as his own. And George has been looking for him. You know, Tom's been sold and sold a few times. Finally finds out where he is. Comes to the shed, rushes in, says, oh, Tom, I found you. Tom, I'm going to buy you. I'm going to take you home. Everything's going to be fine. Tom says, no, you're too late, Master George. I'm almost gone. And there's nothing that makes a better pillow than the thought, nothing can separate me from the love of Christ. And one of the last things he says is, George, Kentucky ain't as good as heaven. I don't know what we have put our affections on, but nothing is as good as heaven.
Amen.
Let's keep that before us. And we can get through any trouble that comes our way if we'll do that. If there's anyone here who needs to get headed toward heaven tonight, repenting of sins, confessing that Jesus is your Lord, being baptized for the remission of sins, we invite you to come now while together we stand and while we sing.